May it please the court, my name is Robert Bruce and my attorney registration number is 17742. I'm here today on behalf of the appellants, Vera and Drayton Dunwoody. We seek to reverse the court's order, which we believe was an effort to provide a convenient access to certain parties in Park County at the expense of certain property rights that my clients owned and preserved in the operation of their guest ranch. As you know from the briefs, there were several bases upon which the court declared some roads that are interior to this guest ranch as first a public road for about 300 feet and then a certain private easement rights for the balance of those roads. When we have the issue that we presented to you of the decision of the public road, we believe that that decision was an error under the Biddle versus Can case that says that the failure to have Park County participating at the trial should have resulted in dismissal because they're indispensable.
Counsel, yes? I want to ask you first, why didn't you mention in your brief that in fact the county had been added as a party to the case and it then sought to be dismissed from the case? Why didn't you mention that in your brief?
Well, to me, Judge, it was the result which was more important, the fact that they were not made a party. It was a bit of a surprise to us that the public road issue was part of the order, having had them dismissed.
But procedurally, it's a whole different issue. Well, it's one issue if, as you characterized it in your opening brief, they were never sought to be added as a party. Okay, that's one decision to review. But the decision here was to grant a motion by the county to have it dismissed from the case. And you did not indicate that to us in your briefs. You did not give us a standard of review for that because you hadn't indicated that's what had happened. Why not?
Well, I guess I did. I think I did give you the standard of review because it is abuse of discretion. Not,
but you didn't give me a standard of review for what actually happened, which was granting of a motion by the county.
Well, I guess I disagree that I didn't give you that, Judge. I say this is abuse of discretion.
Where in your opening brief do you mention that the county had been added as a party?
I don't, but I cite what the standard of review was is abuse of discretion.
And you think that that was an ethical thing to do?
Well, I'm sorry if you think that that was not, Judge. I thought that we were making this argument on the conclusion of what happened at trial. And if my ethics are not what you've expected of me, I apologize.
You led us to believe they had never been added as a party, which was, in fact, is false.
Judge, that wasn't my intent, and I'm expressing that to you and to all of the court. That wasn't my intent. My intent was merely to argue that the decision to find a public road without a party, without a county, was in error.
All right, but the county here entered its appearance, knew what was at stake, knew all the claims, and said, we don't care, in essence. We don't care. So you're trying to protect the county's rights when the county says it doesn't care.
But the thing is the reason that we have the bill case as to why they must care and why it's indispensable is because who polices this part of the road?
We already have a record on that. Jefferson County has an agreement with Park County that Jefferson County will do.
I'm going to ask you to look at that on the record because that's not my understanding of it because that's not what's happening in the private county that's happened.
But again, if the county says whatever you decide is fine with us, then why should we care? Why should you care? You're not the county. You don't represent the county.
Because it's property right on my part, my client's property, which they have to now worry about the maintenance, which isn't being done. They have to worry about days like today when there's accidents upon that part.
Well, because if it's a public road, then the county has to worry about the maintenance.
But the problem is they're not, because they just don't care, as you've said.
You're complaining about something the county itself isn't complaining about and affirmatively said it doesn't care about.
Right, but the problem is when you declare a public road, the county's supposed to care about it.
Well, then you have to go to the county and say, this has been declared to be a public road, you were okay with that, maintain our road, seems to me.
Well, I think that would be contrary to the bill holding. So I may turn to the next issue, which is what we've indicated, and there's some discussion in the brief, is whether there was an easement by estoppel on the private road here. The easement by estoppel was determined and can be, I don't think, inconsistent with the other two bases of the private roads, but it seems that the case law as was set forth in Bollinger versus Neal was that there has to be misrepresentation by the property owner, not by somebody else prior in title. And that's something that was pretty well stated in Bollinger, and I think that the response here is well, that just shouldn't be the law. Well, I think that's about as black letter law as you can get from a 2010 case, and would suggest that that is an error for the balance of that road.
Counsel, I want to talk about that because I've read the Lovato case,
yes.
which of course is a Supreme Court case,
yes.
not a Court of Appeals case, and we have to follow the Supreme Court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, in that case, the court found an easement by estoppel.
They did.
And there was no misrepresentation by the current landowner.
They did.
In fact, the court said, bear with me just a moment. Here we go. Taylor's predecessor in title permitted the settlers to use the land under circumstances in which it was reasonable to foresee that the settlers would substantially change position, believing that the permission would not be revoked. That's exactly the situation we have here, allegedly, predecessors in title. So Lovato is, in fact, a case in which the current landowner made no representation, and yet there was an easement by estoppel.
The Bollinger Court obviously had Lovato in front of it too, and did not see that that set of facts was sufficient for them not to say that provision, that there are no cases that don't hold that the misrepresentation has to come from this party. I agree, Lovato does that.
So Lovato does that.
But I also need to point out two things.
Okay.
First is we've set forth in the record the very factual distinguishments between Lovato and this case. The predecessors entitled in this case did not have in their chain of title any reference to these roads. The probate deed from Elmerburg to Aliceburg, no reference to these roads. As in the Berubian document, there was a reference to these minced profits type of rights to go and get lumber and other sort of supplies. And that was carried from the Berubian deed to the Gilpin deed to apparently other deeds and ultimately to the Taylor deed. So there's some connection in there. Even when Aliceburg conveyed here to the development company, no reference to those particular roads.
But there is a reference to easements, existing rights of way.
There are, yeah, it's the standard thing that you see in most deeds, but nothing particular to these types of roads, which we think should not have been the basis for an equivalent. We're stopped by something that they did or did not do.
How does the fact that your clients appear to have actual knowledge of the existence and use of those roads, how does that play out in the easement by estoppel argument?
They have existing knowledge that the HOA had been paying for those roads. The HOA even paid them for certain maintenance before the dispute arose. They knew that there was some agreement between the two. Remember, for the most part, many of the homeowners within Elk Falls were the members of the Sportsman's Ranch who paid a fee to participate in their activities there and thus to use those roads. And so the knowledge that I think that the record reflects is that there was permissive use, that there was contractual use, that there was paid use, not absolute use without any sort of compensation.
Wasn't there some knowledge that there was an easement by virtue of Mrs. Dunwoody's conversations with the title company officer?
I acknowledge that the title company officer said that. And so that question to me on that actual knowledge piece goes not, because that's in the record, and I can't deny that at all. But to me, that goes not to the issue of equitable estoppel of these people, but to the issue of whether or not there was notice of the common plan. Whether they should have then taken that next step to not just look in the Park County records, but to then look through the Jefferson County records and find the one document which has dotted lines over these roads recorded in about 1960. And the reason I think that you shouldn't say that that's what a party has to do in this case is because, as I cited, that the Supreme Court, who tells us in Rivera, even though it's an advisory opinion to the bankruptcy court, that we're going to take our race notice statutes seriously, and that we're going to require parties to follow those statutes, to get their legal descriptions correct, and record in the right county.
But counsel, actual notice is an exception to race notice.
Right. It's actual notice, though, of these roads,
well,
not of the rights claimed by the other.
Well, they had. She obviously had knowledge of the roads, but there is a message in the record to the title insurance representative from your client saying, quote, according to the Elk Falls B1 plat, there is a 50-foot right-of-way. She, referring to your client, claims there is an easement that we should be showing in our commitment regarding that.
But I don't think that's this easement that she's talking about. She's not talking about the disputed roads, which are now 60 feet in right-of-way and are not in any particular, come from any particular document but the common plan document.
Well, what else could it be?
There are other roads that are there and part and parcel of this which are not disputed.
But this comes on the heels of the title agent telling your client she couldn't, quote, she couldn't possibly be expecting to cut off a roadway that had been used by the Elk Falls people for all those years, 50 or 60 years. It comes on the heels of that. So you can put those together and infer that we're talking about the same roads.
Well, you certainly can infer that, and you have the right to do that in the record. I would suggest to you that because I believe reviewing that common plan document is something that you should do de novo, is that the reasonable and appropriate inference? And that's why we've argued that it is not.
But we can only review what the document itself says de novo. We can't review the document in conjunction with statements and testimony and all that, what that says about actual notice. Actual notice we can't review de novo if it's based on a number of factors, including testimony, the credibility of which is left up to the trial.
I agree. If you decide that testimony says that they have actual notice, then the issue of the race notice is it's one I don't.
Well, I guess it's not that we decided what it means. It's that the trial court decided. Okay, and that's a credibility inferential issue, and we don't review that de novo.
Of course you do not, but you do review recorded documents de novo. So
right.
Should you look de novo at that plat of 1 and 2, which only has the dotted lines, and say that the silence of a legal description and the silence of an intent to grant an easement justified that extra review that was done by the title court and that extrinsic evidence, and we suggest not.
All right, so you're saying the evidence should have been excluded?
Well, that's what we argued at both of the trial court, and that we seem to see it say that you can make that decision de novo on the recorded document itself.
Right, I'm confused because I didn't see an argument in the brief that any evidence should have been excluded here. I thought it was just we have a clearly erroneous ruling or a ruling that's contrary to the record.
Secondly, erroneous, except for in the one instance, Judge, we argued the de novo review, and I think in the connection with the common plan, we argued that extrinsic evidence was improperly presented.
Okay, in the common plan, but what about the easement by estoppel or the easement by prescription?
Well, the easement by prescription, that's the common plan and the easement by ineffective grant.
Ineffective grant, yes. Yeah, yeah.
But I don't think you even get there if you look at that one document and say, you just can't go there. It's not enough for us to take that next step.
But why should the court have been limited to that document? What legal authority is there for nobody can consider anything other than the document? I mean, the law says we consider the surrounding circumstances. It doesn't say if there's any documents, just stop there.
But the law does say if you look at a document and just because it's silent on an issue, that's not evidence of ambiguity.
It may not be conclusive of itself, but it's certainly relevant.
Well, but that's why you have the de novo review. It's relevant to whether there's an ambiguity. And I don't think I think you can look at that document and say there is no ambiguity.
Go ahead.
Judge, I'm going to reserve my last 2 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Frederick Skillern, 7983, and appearing on behalf of the respondent Elk Falls Property Owners Association. The trial court here heard a ton of evidence, nearly 40 witnesses, multiple property owners, and came to an extended series of findings of fact. It's our view here that the issues raised on appeal are primarily those concerning met questions of fact, which were ultimately, to a large degree, decided in favor of the property owners in the subdivision by the trial court. There were three. We asked for findings on certain theories, but the overall fact that took place was this would have been a clear easement shown on a clearly recorded plat had it been signed by Elmer Berg. His wife owned the property on the Jefferson County side because that was the way he structured the family's business affairs. But the court properly noted that all of the evidence showed that those two acted in unison in the setting up of these subdivision plats and subdivision plans. But Mr. Berg was titled in land to the west. On the Block 1 plat, the land on the west side, is labeled as owned by Alice Bird, that was an error.
Well, Mr. Skillern, let's talk about what it means when we say a plat.
Yes.
We have a document, it seems to me, that shows a plat, okay? A plat is something that has boundaries to it, by definition.
Yes, it does.
You are platting a subdivision with boundaries. The easement shown here on the plat for Block 1 show the alleged easement outside the boundaries of the plat.
Yes.
Okay. So, in other words, the easement is not part of the plat as defined by statute.
As defined by statute, one that was adopted 40 years later at a period of time when we did things in a whole lot more detail. Clearly, and Lou Hellerstein was one of the top lawyers in Denver in the 60s and 70s, but clearly there was a detail overlooked. He decided that it was good enough to go with the dotted lines, which, by the way, the record shows were surveyed, tracking out existing roads, the evidence clear on that, to get to what is obviously the only main road coming up to South Elk Falls Road, which is obviously a public road.
Right, but I guess I want to make sure we're not conflating things, because you're saying that had Mr. Bird signed this, it would have been an effective grant, but the easements are outside the platted boundaries. Okay, so I'm just wondering what if his signature would have had any effect at all for anything, because he didn't own the property in Block 1. Mrs. Bird owned that property. And it doesn't appear they were trying to convey something outside of the plat. They were platting something with boundaries.
Well, they were either trying to convey it or they were reflecting the general understanding that the surveyors had and that the surveyors communicated to the planning director, that their belief was that it was at least an easement or a public road. That gets be pretty vague.
That's arguable, but it wouldn't have as much probative force if it were in the plat, for example, obviously. Right.
That's right, which would have involved having the county commissioners of Park County approve the plat and all that, and it was a shortcut, there's no doubt about it. But that doesn't subtract from the very well-established law recited in a different aspect of the Bollinger decision and in cases going well back in Colorado, saying that an easement can be created on a plat. And and that's a plat map in the sense that we use a subdivision plat or just in any map that is signed, attached to an easement agreement and recorded. There's really not a whole lot of dispute that what is tracked out here in survey fashion, which was established in the record by our survey evidence and included in the final court decree, was detailed. It shows where it goes. The evidence shows it was consistent with the road in place. They were attempting to track the course of roads then in use. And the only access at that time from the cabins and the old predecessor plat Block 1 to the public road. Yes, it could have been done with greater detail. It could have been done to 21st century standards by 17th Street lawyers looking over how you do it, but it was just done in a simpler fashion at that point in time. There was no case on that subject in Colorado concerning how a plat, drawings on a plat, language on a plat may create an easement. None of those cases say that the easement itself has to be on that plat. I'm not aware of any case like that.
It wasn't recorded in Park County either.
It wasn't. It wasn't.
A person searching the records of Park County to see if there's an easement wouldn't have come across this document.
Well, in fact, you would if you were actually looking at the documents in the chain of title, because the deeds, for example, from Mrs. Bird in 68 to the Elk Falls Development Company, referenced in argument, deeds, exhibits 22 and 23. There were four deeds, all signed at the same closing, all on the same date, notarized by the same person, and signed by the same people. Four deeds consecutively signed, some for land in Park County, some for land in Jefferson County, but the deeds that were involving Park County land, Exhibit 22, and that conveyed the Park County land to the development company, has continual references in there to Block 1 of the Jefferson County plat, which, you know, because it's part of the legal description, up to the west end of Block 1, etc. They're using it as a boundary description, and then, of course, there's, as was noted, there are exceptions to established rights of way, or, you know, in existence or whatever. So there are anyone seriously looking, and the chain of title to the Dunwights is not extensive. There's a deed from Mrs. Berg to the development company, and then 50 years later, a deed from the development company in 2008 to the Dunwights.
Which, unfortunately, for your clients, did not specifically reserve the easement, right?
Well, I think that was almost it didn't specifically reserve an easement right,
but mention.
It clearly says that deed, Exhibit B and Exhibit 114, takes a specific exception to right-of-way for Park County Road 1184. That's the extension of South Elk Creek Road between the two blocks, and all roadways as depicted on the recorded plats of Blocks 1, 2, and 3.
So that incorporates this plat?
Okay. Yes. It's a clear reference to it. It's a clear reference that the seller's not warranting title to that, and that they're taking subject to an easement, whether it exists or not. I mean, we're here saying...
Which may have led to the conversation between Mrs. Dunwoody and the title agent about the road.
That's a good point, because in that conversation took place in between this final version of the title commitment, Exhibit 193, and the earlier four versions, starting with Exhibit 189. Initially, the references to Blocks 1, 2, and 3 was an exclusion contained in the legal description. After that discussion and so forth, and Ms. Dyer having a clear concern about what the Dunwights were thinking about closing these long-established roads, then added that specific language in this final version of the title commitment. You know, bottom line, it was being discussed. They had clear actual knowledge of it, and they closed full well knowing that they had no warranties and that they're concerning roadways as depicted on the recorded plats of Block 1, 2, and 3. So forth. Also, stipulations in the trial management order that Dunwoody's had lived on adjoining land to Block 1 for 6 years, since 2002, and had actually purchased a lot, Tract K, in Block 1 in 2006. And their access to that lot was, guess what, through these same disputed roads. So, of course, they had actual knowledge of neighborhood use of these disputed roads and so forth. The testimony from the huge accuser and Mr. Gass particularly, that short piece of testimony, very telling. Mr. Gass's father started the Homeowner Association, was an original founding member of the development company, whereby a bunch of the neighbors bought the surrounding land because it would be a wonderful amenity for the neighborhood. And Mr. Gass started all that. He signed the Block 3 plat as the title examiner for the buyer. There is a common connection there, and clearly the development company had all kinds of knowledge of what these plats said, and they continued this common plan and development in their work then. The testimony of his son, Dick Gass, who's a past chair of the real estate section of the CBA and well-versed in these title matters, is very interesting and very good. And he says, yes, we went there as kids. When we were kids in the 60s, this was the main road to the neighborhood for everybody who lived in the neighborhood at that point in time. He had knowledge of being there in the 70s, and he testified about how he got in trouble at a party and so forth and so on. And then in the 80s, after his father passed away, he joined the board of directors of the development company. He inherited his father's stock there, and he became counsel for the development company. And he testified that through all of his contact with the association in a legal capacity and before, it was just generally thought by the development company that these were public roads. So we have made a little mistake on everybody's side. Nothing is clear. But what is clear is that people had a very solid justification for believing they had rights to use the historic accesses to the main entrance to this development, and that they did so for 40 years without objection, without any stopping by the development company, It would just be, when we're talking about implied easements, and Lobato v. Taylor has said that the primary function policy behind implied easements is honoring parties' intentions and avoiding injustice. And what the trial court felt very clearly and exhibited in its findings is that it would be unjust, after 50 years of habitual use of these main access roads to the neighborhood, which are more convenient, sometimes the alternate roads more dangerous, but whatever. There's no basis for coming in after 50 years of extended use in this way, where nobody even discussed the question of a right to use these roads, to have a new owner come in and say, aha, we're going to close these roads and you're going to live your lives differently because we found a mistake in your chain of title. Because Elmer Bird didn't own that land on the west side of the subdivision plat.
Mr. Skiller, I want to ask you about this common development plan issue.
Yes.
Because your argument is focused upon the existence of the common development plan, but there's a second element, and that is that the easement has to be subject to an easement declaration. That's a requirement from the restatement. An implied easement is created when the owner of the servient estate conveys a lot in a common development and does so subject to an easement declaration. What is the easement declaration?
I'd say the easement declaration, if that's a requirement. I'm not sure if you read Taylor versus Melton and go back to the, some of the even pre-Kyler cases dealing with the common law of common planning development, I'm not sure that's required. If the restatement says it, it's for whatever worth is the restatement says we have. But if there's an easement declaration, the plat is a part of the declaration, and the easement is created on the plat, and then as a part one of the process, and then when lots are sold by the developer pursuant to the plat, that's when the easement is created in favor of each individual owner. I think the court's findings on the common plan and design, showing that if you look at Exhibit 258 and the last paragraph of Exhibit 45, which is the history, Elmer Bird envisioned a small city up at Elk Falls. He envisioned multiple subdivisions going into the future, having a recreation club, just as this development company formed. But I'd say, in specific answer to the question, it's the reflection on the plat, a 50-foot right-of-way. What is a layperson supposed to think that means, other than the fact that that's a right-of-way that they can use? There's no logic saying it's for anybody else's benefit. I want to address the attorney's fees issue. We claim attorney's fees under the Section 123 of the Kiowa on the same theory as the Cody Park case, determined by a panel of this court, saying that there is no specific limitation on a claim for attorney fees for involving enforcement of a declaration by an association, that the fees are sought by, and we would say, or recovered against an adjoining property owner to the subdivision, especially here where the adjoining property owner, the Dunwoodies, is really a successor to the original developer of the subdivision. So we ask that the court affirm the findings of the trial court, which are largely factual, and that the facts drive this case, and request award of attorney fees under the Cody Park case. Thank you very much. My time is up.
May it please the court, I would like to address that issue on attorney's fees because I think it goes to a question that Judge Jones asked that I wanted to talk about as it creates the easement on this map or common plan. We have the precision of the Kiowa Act, which we have cited to you, that says it has to be a plat recorded in the county where it exists. We've acknowledged it doesn't record in Park County. So that act cannot apply. They're trying to not only bootstrap something in Jefferson County with a mistake on the best level of an easement into the specific requirements of a plat for the purpose of Kiowa all to get their attorney's fees. We're here to talk about injustice. My client's property is being taken for them for convenience in an effort to say that something is not just. And that's, we would believe, indicative that not only should fees not be awarded, but another persuasive reason why this easement that they have now been awarded is not an easement that they should own. Judge Jones, you had asked, how does this meet the restatement test of a map? And there was an earlier discussion from Mr. Skillern about, I don't know of any cases that say that there's anything in particular that you need, but what the restatement to section 13 says, and yes, it is only the restatement, but Colorado seems to rely on restatement of property quite a bit. It says specifically that it can be an easement off of a map or a plat if the party who is platting the property has the capacity to grant the easement. That would have been Aliceburg, not Elmerburg. There seems to be some belief that this great lawyer, Mr. Hellerstein, just made a mistake and didn't have Elmerburg sign the plat. But isn't it more likely that this lawyer, who was apparently well-respected and knowing his property law, didn't have him sign it because he wasn't an owner and it wasn't supposed to be a grant of an easement?
What was it supposed to be then?
I think it was just a depiction of a possibility of the future.
Then why would it refer to as a right-of-way then?
Those roads did exist. It was a right-of-way if you paid for them. That's what my client's position was. And that's what their understanding was. Each of these people were paying for those rights to the extent they wanted them or needed them, or also wanted to participate in the sportsman club. Now, the same type of business owned and operated by the Dunwoodies.
Can you imagine a lawyer putting the word right-of-way on a plat and saying, it's just a thought for the future, it doesn't really have any meaning of right-of-way?
Yes, because sometimes on plats we identify vicinities and thoughts and possibilities for the future. But in order to make those binding matters, Judge, you actually have to have the legal capacity to create the easement, and that was Elmerburg. And if it was just a mistake, that could have been solved when Aliceburg got the property, and that she then said, I hereby create the easement for the benefit of the Homeowners Association. She didn't do that. She could have reserved an easement when she deeded it to the development company. She didn't do that. And so that's why, in sum, we believe that this order of the court should be reversed, and that, yes, if there was a mistake in property matters, it shouldn't be reflected in more property rights to someone else.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case will stand submitted, and counsel are excused, and opinion will issue in due course.